The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So, in the last few weeks, we've been talking about working with emotions. And primarily in the last few weeks, talking about working with difficult emotions, the afflictive emotions, the emotions that we typically end up suffering over. And today, I'd like to change the direction a little bit and talk about some of the emotions that start to come up as we practice. So the more wholesome kinds of emotions, the emotions that support our practice and that are also naturally uncovered and revealed essentially as we practice. So there's a way that the states of greed, aversion, delusion, which are the kind of root source of all of those afflictive emotions, as those start to thin out, as the roots of greed, aversion, and delusion start to lessen, we start to experience more and more moments where there's much less of those states going on, and the result is that we can feel quite good. So there's a lot of lists, actually, of some of these wholesome emotions. And I'm just going to review kind of briefly some of these lists just to give you a kind of range of the territory of some of these emotions. Because sometimes when we think about emotions, we mostly think about difficult emotions. That's kind of where our minds go, in a way. And there's less of a sense of what these wholesome or beautiful emotions are. And there's one set that I think I'll start with. It's kind of what I think of as the emotional map of a heart that has let go of greed, aversion, and delusion. That in that letting go of greed, aversion, and delusion, there's a kind of a natural uncovering of a heart of kindness, the heart of metta, the quality of loving kindness. And this quality of kindness, when it meets something difficult, it feels like compassion. When this quality of kindness, of open-heartedness, of this just open, the sense of the heart being open and not contracted, which is, you know, the space of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion is really an open-heartedness, a willingness to meet what is present. And that quality itself, that willingness, non-resistance, that allowing quality, is that kind of kindness and is that acceptance. And when that open heart meets suffering, the response is compassion. When that open heart meets joy, when it meets something to appreciate, whether in oneself or others, there's a response of kind of lightness, of a happiness, of what would we can call appreciative joy, or perhaps sympathetic joy or empathetic joy, which can be experienced as you see somebody else being joyful. That open heart just naturally responds by like resonating, like I like the term sympathetic. Because from music, there's the term of sympathetic vibration of a string. You know, if you've got strings that are next to each other, when you hit one of the strings, the vibration of that one begins to resonate a sympathetic resonance with the next string. And so there's a small overtone that comes. And it's kind of like that with our heart. When the heart is open and it sees or meets joy, it kind of just resonates in kind. To give you a taste of this, of what this is like, you know, just think about seeing a baby smile. You know, the kind of joyfulness that babies have when they are in that space of seeing that they can accomplish something or do something, or that they feel, you know, there's nothing wrong at this moment, you know, my diaper's dry and I'm full, and there's just this, like, you know, oh, happiness, and there's just the laughter and bubbling. And in the response, when the heart is available for that, we feel it too. So that's the quality of mudita, of sympathetic joy. And then this open-heartedness, the ability or the willingness for that open-heartedness to meet anything without getting swept away by it. It's so easy, you know, when our heart is open, to get actually a little bit lost in both either the suffering or the joy. And the additional quality of mind that comes into balance this is equanimity. It's this balance of mind, the mind that just can meet whatever is happening, just meet it without resistance, without clinging to it, without having to have it or having to get rid of it, but just meeting it, meeting this feeling of compassion, the suffering, and feeling the compassion that arises because of the suffering, meeting the feeling of joy and the feeling of the sympathetic joy that arises because of that, and not needing any of it to change. Now, that when I said that, not needing any of it to change, there is a way that that the emotion of compassion, in effect, comes with a wish to relieve that suffering. So, and that's also a wholesome wish. But it's not the kind of wish that feels like this has to change because this is, you know, the state that I'm in is not acceptable. I have to do something in order to change things so that I'm not feeling this way anymore. You know, that when the heart, the compassionate heart, has a sense of wishing to respond, but without needing a particular result, effectively. So it doesn't need things to change, but it has that impetus, that wish to relieve the suffering. And that's a wholesome, a beautiful wish. So in a way, you know, as the hindrances settle, as the reactive emotions settle, and we're not so much in the space of reactivity, these qualities, the qualities of an open heart, begin to reveal these beautiful emotions: kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And yet, at times, our habit of engaging, our habit of engaging in the world, is so much out there. It's so much with the things in the world that even as this reactivity thins out, we still have this habit of being focused outwardly. And we might miss that there is the initial stirrings of kindness, the initial stirrings of compassion, because our attention is focused not towards how is the mind receiving experience? But it's still out there in the world, noticing, you know, the kind of objects in the world. And so there's a shift that can start to happen for us in our practice. As we engage in our practice, these qualities, these beautiful qualities, and I'm going to mention some more of them in a little while, these beautiful qualities start to become cultivated just through the act of mindfulness, just through the paying attention. And yet if our habit of paying attention is to be noticing the things we're paying attention to rather than the quality of the mind that is knowing, we might miss. It might not be as so clear to us that these qualities are coming along for the ride as we're bringing mindfulness to our experience. And so just beginning to, in the exploration of practice, as you are attending to your experience, beginning to notice when there might be at times you might notice if you're paying attention to something difficult, for instance, you're paying attention to a difficult emotion. You might notice sometimes that there's a shift that happens in the paying attention where suddenly it's like, oh, it's not a problem anymore. It's just this phenomenon. It's just this feeling. It's just bodily sensations. And so there's a little bit of a shift, and there's a kind of a releasing or relaxing around that difficult emotion. And so in that paying attention to that difficult emotion, the quality of mindfulness is being cultivated, and potentially this quality of compassion, of the open-hearted response to suffering. And in meeting our experience, we can start to recognize that quality of compassion, the quality of kindness is coming along with this engagement, with this practice of observing our experience. So the instructions, or some of the instructions about paying attention to experience, are in the teaching, the Buddhist teaching on wise effort. And this is a teaching about letting go of things that are unskillful, so letting go of things that are rooted in greed, aversion, and delusion. It's about creating the conditions such that those difficult states, or the states that come out of greed and aversion and delusion, don't arise if they're not there. So there's that aspect of it. You know, there's a lot of the practice of our mindfulness is in this area of meeting our difficulty, meeting our unskillful qualities of mind that are rooted out of greed, aversion, and delusion. The teaching on right wise effort is when those arise, see if you can let go of them. But that letting go, the letting go quality of the mind, sometimes we can actively let go. Sometimes we can actively let go of something that's difficult. But more often, it's about bringing that mindfulness and letting be, letting that experience be. And in the letting be, watching it release and watching it let go. Does that make sense? So there's that aspect of our practice that a lot of it is in that area. You know, we meet our struggles with mindfulness, and we just allow them. There's the allowing aspect. Now that allowing aspect brings in that quality of the open heart. And this brings us to the other half of wise effort, which is about cultivating wholesome qualities of mind and supporting or sustaining them, you know, cultivating those that have not arisen to arise and sustaining those that have arisen. So this is the other aspect, the other half of our practice, is to recognize and cultivate these wholesome, beautiful qualities that come with mindfulness, come with the practice. So in this exploration of, so there's the cultivating wholesome states that have not come into being. And there's a way that we can do this actively, as for instance, practicing the practice of metta, cultivating the practice of metta, turning the attention towards cultivating patience, actively doing practices which support those qualities. And there are kind of more indirect ways of cultivating these qualities. And mindfulness is one of them. That bringing mindfulness to our experience cultivates more mindfulness. It cultivates this open-heartedness. It cultivates this balance of mind, the equanimity. So even if we're paying attention to something challenging or difficult in our experience, bringing mindfulness to it, this aspect of wise effort, of cultivating the wholesome qualities, is happening. It's already happening as we bring mindfulness to our experience. In the first place, we're cultivating mindfulness, which itself is a very beautiful quality of mind. It's not exactly an emotion, but it's a very beautiful quality of mind that one of my teachers, Sayadaw Upendita, said it is the most wholesome mind state. And essentially it is the quality of mind that leads us away from unwholesome mind states towards wholesome mind states. That the bringing mindfulness to our experience kind of includes that in its nature in a way. It's kind of got this, it feels to me almost like this, it feels like a kind of a magic power or something, that it's when we bring mindfulness to something unwholesome, we bring mindfulness to a state that's motivated out of aversion, for example. When we bring mindfulness to that state, it creates the conditions for that state to appear less frequently in our experience. So it has a natural kind of diminishing power with those difficult states of mind. And when we bring our mindful attention to something wholesome, something beautiful, bring our mindful attention to compassion, to kindness, it creates the conditions for that to appear more frequently in our experience. So it's got this natural movement. It's just the way our minds are built in a way. We don't have to do this. Bringing this non-judgmental, mindful quality of attention to something difficult, we understand the suffering. We learn about the suffering that's inherent in that struggle. When we bring our mindful attention to something that is wholesome, we see directly the ways that it leads us away from suffering. And the mind kind of naturally wants to go there. When the mind understands on its own that what it's doing is involving itself in suffering, it begins to naturally let go of that. And that's my understanding about how this works, that this mindfulness kind of, if you want to, put a kind of a visual analogy on it, it's as if the difficult states shrink in the clarity and brightness of the mindfulness. And the wholesome states like grow and bask in the light and the warmth of the mindfulness. So just bringing mindfulness, we begin to cultivate these beautiful qualities. And what I'm suggesting is that in the practice of mindfulness, you can begin to recognize some of these qualities that are coming along. So often in our mindfulness practice, we're focused on the thing that we're paying attention to and not how we're paying attention and what's in the mind that is paying attention. So it's a little bit of a shift for us to open to, well, what else is here as I'm bringing this attention? You could do it with a question. You know, is there, what else is here right now? You may notice, I mean, this kind of a question may actually reveal to you that there is some additional kind of aversion or greed or delusion present, you know, as you turn your attention, you know, as you're paying attention to anger or something arising out of aversion, and paying attention to that, and is there something else here? Is there something else in the mind? Yeah, I don't like this, you know, and that you notice that, and that's not a problem. You know, just recognize that that's actually part of this kind of practice, that it begins to reveal to us, oh, there's actually some not liking going on that I hadn't really noticed. So this is the beginning to open your mind to the things that are driving the way we're paying attention. And as we begin to kind of pull back the layers of that, we can end up landing in these states of kindness, that we're observing something difficult in our experience, and we see there's just this quality of warmth or friendliness. The mind feels allowing and accepting of that. And so this turning towards that begins to shine the light of awareness and recognition on that allowing quality itself, on that quality of kindness, of friendliness itself. And that in turn strengthens that allowing quality. So, you know, we can simply just pay attention to the things in our experience, and it can be very powerful to do that. But to begin to recognize the beautiful qualities that are coming along with it is also a very powerful practice, to begin to acknowledge the kindness, the acceptance, the compassion that are being cultivated as we practice our mindfulness. So I'll stop there for a moment and see whether there's any thoughts or comments about what I've said so far. Oh, okay.
I see there's a reluctance to recognize the sweet things about ourselves.
Do you see that in your own experience?
Yes. Uh-huh. And that's the culture, I think, that's the culture we grew up in. But it's true. It is true. And last night, Gil was talking about the third noble truth, the letting go or cessation of suffering. And some of the comments from the group was that when you're focusing on something, you're attached to something, that you miss all the other things that are around.
Yes.
And once the letting go comes, it seems almost like there's a natural, and that's what you were saying, there's a natural compassion.
Yes.
A desire to serve, a desire to empathize. And it doesn't. You don't have to work at it.
Yes.
The work comes for me in the letting go of the clinging.
And in that work of letting go of the clinging, there's kind of two sides of it. You know, that the letting go of the clinging is as I described it earlier, can be there's the kind of letting be, you know, allowing that experience of the clinging, and watching it begin to let go of itself. I mean, we can sometimes actively let go, but sometimes we can't. You know, sometimes we just, I remember sitting in one retreat and feeling just this clutching of clinging in my mind, and it's like, oh, I'd let go if I knew how. you know? And at that point, it's just like all that the mind could do is just watch the holding and just be at ease around the holding itself. And so there's that, you know, there's the watching of that experience. And sometimes when we are doing that, there's kind of an agenda around the watching in order that it will end. You know, there's that agenda. I'm watching this so that it will let go. As opposed to simply watching it out of compassion or watching it out of kindness. So that, you know, there's the two sides of it. There's the thing that we are watching, and there's the relationship of our mind to the watching. And the what I'm pointing to here is that a lot of these qualities can be in that relationship too, and they might be missed. So that you know, to just start in that process of the observing the clinging, and to see from time to time how is the mindfulness of this impacting the rest of the mental environment? Is it bringing in a sense of compassion or of allowing acceptance of kindness?
One of Jack Kornfield's books gave me this, I call it prayer, and then I added a few things to my, and it's just so helpful to me because I pray it for myself and for the people, especially the ones I have difficulty with. And it goes like this, and you know it, I'm sure. May you be held in compassion. May your pain and sorrow be eased. May your boundless heart be open. May you know the beauty of your own true self. May you be healed. May you be a source of healing to others. May you be at peace. And I pray that for myself as mm-hmm. often as I do for mm-hmm. others. And it has just been magical.
Uh-huh. But what you're referring to there are statements of intention towards these qualities that I was referring to. So I can't remember exactly what they were, but the may you be at ease is a statement of intention towards metta, towards kindness. Mm-hmm. May you be free from your suffering or sorrow is a statement of intention towards compassion. May your abundance grow is a statement of intention towards that quality of sympathetic joy. May you know your own true journey, your own true path, is a statement of the intention towards equanimity. So that prayer encompasses essentially a cultivation of these beautiful qualities. So that's one way towards inclining the mind towards these qualities. And if you've seen you said it's been really supportive for you, so you've started to see your heart opening. So this practice that you describe, that's a beautiful one to do because it brings all of the qualities, these four qualities together in a very short kind of prayer, in a sense. So that's a beautiful way to begin cultivating these qualities. And when in noticing that the shift of heart or the ease that comes there when you use that prayer, take that in with mindfulness. Let yourself resonate with that feeling. What is it? Get familiar with it. The familiarity with these qualities begins to support their recognition. We recognize them more often when they are present. And having the sense of them in that kind of cultivation, you begin to sense there's a kind of a feeling of settling into those qualities and not so much of the feeling of resisting these beautiful qualities. Yeah, it's interesting how much we do resist some of these beautiful states. I mean, I remember on one retreat where I had this opening to metta. You know, it was just such a beautiful, I had been resisting and a kind of a feeling of contraction, and I was just with that feeling of contraction, and it was getting larger and larger, and at some point that feeling just flipped and turned into the feeling of this love, you know, just a feeling of really broad, expansive love. The next thought in my mind was, well, this is stupid, this is sappy. Very next thought. I saw the thought, and then I laughed. You know, it's like, wow, okay. You know, this is probably why the resistance was there. You know, there's that kind of you know, view that we have. These qualities are less worthy somehow, or you know, I'm not sure why, but we do have that kind of view, you know. So it's amazing, and you know, if you can be humorous about it, I mean, like I was glad that I could laugh about it when I saw that. It's like, oh, look at that! This is sappy. No wonder. No wonder I've been resisting this feeling. So yeah, we do resist it, and also there are times when I've noticed, you know, strong feelings, beautiful feelings come up, and it's so unfamiliar or so, you know, strong in a way. It's like, wow, I don't know if I can handle this feeling. I remember sitting at my kitchen table, I think it was shortly after a retreat, and I was just, you know, feeling this upwelling of joy. Beautiful kind of feeling of just joyfulness, and there was this kind of feeling of, oh, this is too much, you know, I can't handle this. And so there was this kind of pushing down on it, but it was strong, and at some point the mind of wisdom came in and said, don't worry, it's impermanent, it won't last.
You don't have to enjoy it for very long.
That's right. And then what happened was that resistance let go, and it got really intense really quickly. It's like this geyser. And then it kind of settled to a much more just peaceful happiness. So, you know, that kind of resistance to these beautiful emotions, you know, it'll keep an eye out for that. Oh, go ahead, yeah.
About the resistance, it's just hitting me. I mean, I know this is an intellectual thought, and I deal with these kinds of things all the time in the kind of work that I do, but when you said sappiness, what occurs to me is our minds will produce that kind of label or judgment about the experience, and we'll say something like, we'll give it sappiness. But what I really think is happening is, I think we're born with a natural desire to connect and to have all these feelings we now are talking about being open to. But as you live a life and interact with people and with life in general, you encounter pain. Mm-hmm. You encounter disappointment. You encounter disillusionment. I think these are all aversions. And so we develop what, you know, I'm talking in psychological terms, but defenses against, yes, those vulnerabilities.
Yep.
So when our mind produces a label, sappiness, what we're really saying is, don't go there. I've already
been hurt. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, I mean, the hurt can happen in different ways. I mean, you know, just you know, the kind of expressing that vulnerability as a teenager or as a youngster, and having your peers say, "Oh, that's stupid," you know. And so there's a kind of a sense of, you take that in as being, "Oh, well, that's the way it is. It is stupid," or you feel, "Ooh, you know, don't show that."
That's shame.
Yeah, that's shame.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, we need to There's a kind of a funny thing here. I mean, you know, we need to allow that resistance as well. We can't have a judgmental, negative attitude towards the sappy feeling, the stupid feeling. It's like we have to just, oh, there's that. Okay. You know, and can we be allowing and open-hearted about that? You know, when things have come into being, you know, things come into being, they're already there. You know, it's like you can't put the genie back in the bottle. It's already present. And the way through it is to meet it. But so much of our way of dealing with it is like, oh, stuff that in, you know, trying to put the genie back in the bottle. It's like trying to somehow pretend that hadn't happened. But just being able to meet anything, this capacity of the open heart can meet anything. And it's quite amazing to feel that when you begin to really trust that. That trust is one of the beautiful qualities that is developed. And there's another list that, you know, that I was almost going to segue into a few minutes ago, that as we start to feel these qualities of kindness, of open-heartedness, coming along with the practice, there's a little bit of confidence that gets developed. It's like, wow, we really start to see that this is heading us in the direction towards really beautiful qualities, really open-hearted states. And so there's the confidence that comes in. And that is the first in another list of beautiful qualities called the five faculties. And these are the qualities of confidence, of energy directed to the practice, of energy directed towards opening the heart, of mindfulness, of concentration, and of wisdom. And these qualities are essentially kind of the, again, they're not quite emotions, most of them. Confidence has a flavor of emotion, but energy isn't so much. Mindfulness isn't quite an emotion. Concentration and wisdom aren't really emotions, but they're mental qualities that impact the environment of our minds in a beautiful way and tend to lead us more towards these beautiful emotions of kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. I think of that list as really being the kind of emotional map of a heart that is free, you know, that's how it's going to be responding, is with those qualities. But this other list, these faculties, they're essentially the qualities that allow us to cultivate the skill of being present. And they are, as we bring our mindfulness towards our experience, the quality of confidence can build, and we can have a sense of that. It's like, oh yeah, I can actually do this. You know, that when you're bringing attention to something challenging, you have a sense of, I can meet this. That's confidence. If there's a sense of engagement, a sense of, you know, meeting it, that's the energy. You know, the sense of, you know, just moving towards as opposed to shrinking. That's the energy directed towards the practice. The mindfulness being the recognition of what's happening. The concentration being a kind of a stabilizing of the mind on experience. And the wisdom being the recognition or the beginning to understand what is helpful for me with respect to letting go of these difficult states and moving towards these skillful states. And so those qualities, they're happening. They're happening as we practice. And to begin to get familiar with and recognize them supports their, so mindfulness of these wholesome states supports their cultivation. So to just, I don't want to make this too much of a project or too much of a doing, but to just occasionally from time to time turn towards the kind of environment of the mind that's paying attention and see what's there. You know, is there a sense of confidence present? Is there a sense of allowing? Is there a fear? We might find that. And if that's present, bringing it into the field of what's known so that it's not operating under the surface, not kind of operating in the background, we can watch and witness anything with this balanced allowing awareness, even fear, even anger, even frustration. So that was a little segue. Yeah, go ahead.
You may recall that I mentioned last week honking and yelling at another driver. Well, I almost did it again this morning. But something stopped me from either the honk or the yell. And then a few moments later, I said to myself, sort of, I've been trying this mindfulness for years, but I don't really trust it. Mm-hmm. So you got to that just a moment ago in a brief way. And I guess the question is that before I experience all these benefits that I've heard over and over again, and I must say I have experienced them occasionally, but how does the Buddha have anything to say about the trust? Or do you have anything to say about the trust prior to
the experience.
Major experience of the benefits?
Well, I would reflect on those places where you may have seen small benefits. Part of it for me is that the beginning level of trust is kind of like more of a willingness. That, you know, we can't have the experience before we engage, right? So it's kind of, that's a chicken and an egg problem there. So it's kind of a sense of having enough willingness, so enough confidence in what you've heard to be willing to engage. Even that amount of willingness is the beginning of confidence. So if there's a willingness to set aside our habitual ways of doing things, to just meet our experience. One of the ways that I've thought about this for myself, I mean, I'm an analyzer. I mean, my mind just analyzes endlessly. And the instruction is usually let go of the analysis and, you know, be with what is happening. Which may be the process of analysis, but, you know, to be with that as a process rather than as the content. And there's kind of a sense of not trusting that. You know, it's like, you know, this is the way I've lived my life, this analysis. This is the way I've gotten through the world, and it's been very effective, thank you very much. I'm not really that interested in giving it up.
Were you listening to me this morning?
I've just watched my own mind a lot. So the thing that I've come back to for myself in that is, in terms of this analysis, the Buddha didn't actually ask me to believe him. So there's the kind of what we're doing here isn't about believing. It's about being willing to engage. So it's kind of to me has been this notion of saying to myself, okay, the Buddha didn't say I had to believe him. He just said, try it and see. See what happens if you let go of this for a little while and just turn towards the experience instead of endlessly thinking about it. And just little by little over time, bringing that reflection in, I began to more and more experience the direct benefits of that letting go of that thinking process towards just the being with. So it's a process, And the more you can, you know, just it will guide you along. There's one teaching around the Dharma, a term that's used with the Dharma, which has many layers of meaning, the Dharma. One of them means what the Buddha taught. Another of it means basically experience as it is, or, you know, things as they are. You know, this is the truth of things as they are. There's one translation actually in this book. Maybe I can find it for you. This is somebody who has gained some confidence in the Buddha, and he's overjoyed, basically. And he says, up till now, before I heard Gautama's teaching, people had always told me this: this is how it's always been, and this is how it will always be. Only the constant refrain of tradition, a breeding ground for speculation. This prince, this beam of light, Gautama, was the only one who dissolved the darkness. This man, Gautama, is a universe of wisdom and a world of understanding, a teacher whose Dhamma is the way things are, instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, and nothing else quite like it anywhere in the world. So that's kind of affirmed confidence. That's, you know, that's the confidence of affirmed. But what I love about this is a teacher whose Dhamma is the way things are. You know, that's his teaching. It's not about believing some view of you know, something or other. It's about, can you meet your experience the way things are? Notice the resistance. Notice the desire to manipulate, to change, to control. Let that be as well. And can you come back to a place of just allowing? That's his instruction. And there's nothing else quite like it anywhere in the world. Most people, most teachers, most religions teach something to believe in. That there's not necessarily a way to experientially verify. And what feels different to me about this teaching is that there's no belief, really. I mean, there's some views that he's saying, it's helpful if you use these views so that you can meet your experience with some more balance of mind. But the teaching is about meeting experience. And so the willingness itself, allow yourself to resonate with that willingness. That's the seed of that trust, essentially. And it will... I was going to this... one of the qualities that's attributed to the Dharma is that it is onward leading. That as you begin to touch into things as they are, you begin to see there's a way that, you know, the bringing mindfulness to experience, even when it's difficult... Initially, it just feels difficult. Initially, it's like, wow, why would I do this? You know, this just feels... It's easier to distract myself to watch television or something, you know, just rather than to be in this space of suffering. But over time, you start to see that the bringing of mindfulness to it is the untangling of that thing, as opposed to the tying it more up in knots. So that it is what sometimes is called, it's the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. The suffering that we experience in our mindfulness is the kind of suffering that leads to the end of suffering. And there can be a kind of a joy in that, in feeling that, oh, I see, this is actually letting go. You know, I'm feeling the suffering of this now, but I'm seeing that it is releasing. And there's a joy that can come with that. So I'd encourage just a couple of pieces. One, just noticing that willingness to engage and, you know, to reminding yourself, at least for me it was helpful to remind myself, I don't have to believe anything. It's a matter of, like, run the experiment. I mean, I was scientifically inclined, so this was helpful for me. It's like, okay, I'm not going to find out the results of this experiment unless I run the experiment. So maybe I should try the experiment. So run the experiment and see what happens. And for me, that was the kind of pathway in. And then to notice, as you have said, you've noticed some small things. So allow yourself to reflect on those small ways that you've noticed some differences. That will also support that trust.
I was reading an article today in the science section of the New York Times about how... I was reading about an article about bullies in high school or in grade school or whatever, children, and that if you're being bullied and you approach the bully with kindness or reconciliation, it makes it worse. And actually, what is wanted there is hostility as a reaction to the bully, because human beings seek asymmetry in their interactions. And so I'm wondering about that. I'm getting very angry at someone as we have this talk today. It's very unpleasant to be here. But I realized, I had an interaction with him a while back, and I've tried to reconcile with this guy. He's kind of anyhow. So, but this last time I had an interaction with him, I just met him with some kind, when he was acting that way, I just met him with some sort of dismissive contempt. And it balanced the whole situation. And I was very aware of my feelings and aware of the whole gestalt of the interaction. And my feeling was irritation in my body, kind of a pain, but also a broader feeling of equanimity about how to handle this situation.
Uh-huh.
So I'm thinking that equanimity was the reward in that?
Yes, that it sounds to me like that's... And in terms of that kind of, meeting, at times there is kind of a, clear defining of boundaries is appropriate. I wouldn't say meeting hostility with hostility, but I'd say meeting hostility with clarity. That this is not appropriate. And to find a way to meet that energy, that kind of, you called it dismissive contempt, probably saying something along the lines of, well, can't we just be friends? That's just going to feed the fire. But to if you can engage in something, a way of speaking from that place of the broader equanimity, I clearly see the kind of movements towards reconciliation or being kind and being friendly. That's just fueled the fire. So let's try something different. If you can engage in that without the kind of contraction of heart, I think that's mostly what we're interested in really is, are we increasing the hostility in our own hearts, or are we increasing the sense of balance of mind? And it sounds like in that situation you had that kind of broader place of balance of mind.
I did, but I also had some contraction in my heart.
Yeah. They come together. I mean, it's like we're not until we're fully free. We're going to have the mixed environment of our mind. But knowing that kind of irritation allowed you to, acknowledge it and have a little more spaciousness about it. I hope that the way you said it or the thing you said was coming more from the... I guess what I'd encourage is in that situation, see if you can have what you're saying come more from the more spacious place than from the contracted place. That there's going to be the mixed environment, and can you incline more towards the skillful motivation? The other piece of this is looking at where self is kind of engendered in the whole process. You know, if somebody is saying something or there's a way that they're engaging in the world and it feels like, you know, absent something like physical violence, you know, if it feels like there's you know, a me here that needs to be defended. You know, that movement itself, if there wasn't the feeling of me needing to defend myself, would it be a problem if this person was saying this thing? So, you know, to kind of use, also it can be interesting to use that kind of interaction as a lesson in what am I clinging to? What is it that I feel like I need to be respected? Is it that I feel like I need to be seen or heard by this person? So, you know, kind of just using it as a kind of a little investigation into what else is being clung to. You know, the Buddha was really radical on these things. You know, in terms of one thing he said, is the simile of the saw was, even if somebody is sawing off your limbs, if you are feeling anything but kindness and compassion towards that person, you're not engaging in my teachings. So, I mean, that's a real, like, koan for us, I think. You know, that even when somebody is depriving you of life, to not move towards greed, aversion, delusion. He was really radical on that. Now he did say, I mean, he didn't say that you couldn't defend yourself. I mean, that you could defend yourself with, essentially, there's this one teaching, another story about Mahamoggallana, who knew that there were these robbers and bandits, they were coming to murder him. And he kept finding ways to not be murdered by them. Not out of fear. I mean, the teaching is, I don't know what was going on in his mind, but the teaching is that this wasn't happening out of fear for his life, but out of compassion for the people who wanted to murder him, because it would be such bad karma for them to murder somebody with such virtue. And so the movement isn't to protect self; it's to be compassionate for the kind of the whole gestalt of it. But yeah, the Buddha didn't say not to protect ourselves, but he did encourage us to try to do it out of kindness, compassion, and equanimity. So that's a very interesting exploration to make. You know, how can I draw boundaries and be really clear without acting out? I mean, you know, you could just be really straight and say, you know, this isn't appropriate. The way you're being is just not appropriate. You know, with a kind of a clarity and forcefulness to it that comes out of that balance of mind. So I may go see if I can find that article. I'm curious about what they had to say about that, meeting hostility with hostility. I mean, the Buddha's teaching is not that. Something he said in the Dhammapada, something like, hatred never ceases through hatred. Through non-hatred alone does it cease. So I guess I'll leave you with that. It's time to end. Thank you.